This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nicholas Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nicholas Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nicholas Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for March 3, 2014. It was a busy week, beginning with an IRS ruling that an entity's late request to change its accounting period will be considered timely filed. We don't know exactly why, but we know exactly how. The IRS gives us the citations for the authority. And then a QUITAM award, Q-U-I-T-A-M, which is an award for an action brought by a private citizen to recover money for the public, in which the private citizen gets part of the award. Craig Patrick thought that should be capital gain. The tax court thought otherwise. Then Lisa Beeman Swint thought that a state court document would allow a non-custodial parent to claim the dependency exemption, but the state court document was deficient in that it did not meet all of the federal requirements. Then Route 231 LLC, an allocation of state tax credits, is found to be a disguised sale. Now, the important thing here, the law has changed. These are Virginia state tax credits. The law has changed, but what I really want to talk about when we get to that point is the characteristics of a disguised sale. Then, Dennis Blanchett did not cooperate with the IRS, and so they took his Social Security payments for 33 months. We have a frequently asked questions on IRS retirement plan audits, the EP Team Audit Program, the EPTA program, for retirement plans of large corporations, those with assets of $10 million or more. Final regulations on property transferred for services, those are the final 83B elections. The limits on depreciation of autos, and by the way, there is no 50% bonus depreciation for 2014, so those limits have fallen to relatively low levels. A decision of the tax court in which a taxpayer who thought she should be entitled to an IRA contribution was not, because even though she didn't get very much benefit, she was a participant in her employer's plan. The Ninth Circuit has affirmed that a tax lien survives bankruptcy and the IRS may in fact levy on a pension plan in Stuart A. Gross, a decision in the Ninth Circuit. And then finally this week, the IRS has updated the frequently asked questions on the net investment income tax to give us additional information on its question number 4. That has to do with foreign tax issues. Well, that's a fairly full boat. Let's get started. In Private Letter Ruling 2014-08-028, the IRS rules that an entity's late request to change its accounting period will be considered timely filed. Section 1.442-1B of the Income Tax Regulations provides that in order to secure the Commissioner's consent to a change in annual accounting period, the taxpayer must file an application on Form 1128 with the Commissioner within such time and in such manner as is provided in administrative procedures provided by the Commissioner. Section 6.02 of Revenue Procedure 2002-39 requires the taxpayer to file a Form 1128 no earlier than the day following the end of the first effective year and no later than the due date, not including extensions, by the way, and that's where they got in trouble here, of the federal income tax return for the first effective year. The taxpayer requesting this ruling did not file its Form 1128 by the due date of the return for the short period, not including extensions. But the taxpayer requested an extension of time to file its Form 1128 soon thereafter. Section 301.9100-3A provides that requests for extension of time for regulatory elections that do not meet the requirements of 301.9100-2 for automatic extensions must be made under the rules of 301.9100-3. Those will be granted when the taxpayer provides evidence to establish that the taxpayer acted reasonably and in good faith, and that the granting of relief will not prejudice the interest of the government. We don't know all the facts, but we do know that the taxpayer here convinced the government that they should be granted permission to make the late change. Then we have Craig Patrick, 142 TC number 5, in which the tax court holds that a QUITAM award did not qualify for capital gains treatment. Mr. Patrick was awarded a percentage of the proceeds of a lawsuit he brought privately on behalf of the government to recover money that his employer was getting from the government inappropriately. The They filed their complaint alleging their employer defrauded the government by improperly marketing the company's medical equipment, and they won. They got an award. Now, the government got most of the money, but Mr. Patrick got some of the money. He reported the money as a capital gain. The tax court examines that position. First, the sale or exchange requirement wasn't met. The relator, Mr. Patrick, did not sell or exchange information for a fixed amount of money or in return for other property. The information provided to the government did not qualify as a capital asset. Patrick's right to income was attributable to a reward, and a reward is always going to be treated as ordinary income. Further, the information Mr. Patrick gave to the government wasn't a capital asset because he didn't have a legal right to exclude others from the use and enjoyment of the property at issue. Lisa Beeman Swint was not entitled to a dependency exemption, deduction, and a child tax credit that she and her late husband, a non-custodial parent, claimed for his child. The court ruled, in 142 TC number 6, that a state court document that conditionally allowed him to claim the deduction and credit did not meet the requirements of Section 152E2A. Any right to claim a dependent that is conditioned on some performance of a duty by the non-custodial parent will not be effective for federal tax law. In this case, the state court entry failed to meet the requirements that the release include the signature of the custodial parent for the exemption deduction. The document also failed to meet another requirement of Section 152E2A, that the declaration be unconditional, because it included a condition that Mr. Swint could only claim the deduction if he was current on his child support obligations. The attempt to allocate the dependency exemption and the child tax credit to him failed as a matter of federal law. Route 231 LLC is a transaction involving the allocation of state tax credits that the tax court held in TC Memo 2014-30 was a disguised sale. Now, I'm not so concerned about the Virginia tax credits as I am as this case standing very clearly for what is and is not a disguised sale. The facts are that a conservation partnership made a capital cash contribution to a limited liability company, followed by the limited liability company's allocation of state tax credits to the partnership. The court first had to hold that the state tax credits were property in the hands of the LLC, which made this a disguised sale transaction under Section 707A, and they went on to hold that the proceeds from the disguised sale were income to the LLC in the tax year it acquired and sold the credits. Section 1.707-3B2 of the Income Tax Regulations provides a list of 10 facts and circumstances that may tend to prove the existence of a sale under Section 1.707-3B1. The following 6 facts and circumstances, which are commonly present, were found to be present in this transaction. The timing and amount of a subsequent transfer was determinable with reasonable certainty at the time of the first transfer. The transferor had a legally enforceable right to the subsequent transfer. The partner's right to receive the transfer of money or other consideration was secured. Some person had loaned or has agreed to loan the partnership the money or other consideration required to enable the partnership to make the transfer, taking into account whether any such lending obligation is subject to contingencies related to the results of partnership operations, that the transfer of money or other consideration by the partnership to the partner is disproportionately large in relationship to the partner's general and continuing interest in partnership profits, and finally, that the partner has no obligation to return or repay money or other consideration to the partnership. Because the Virginia tax credits were found to be property in the hands of the limited liability company, that made the determination that there was a transfer easy. The amount of income picked up by the LLC from the disguised sale? A little over $3 million. Dennis Blanchette was pretty sure that the IRS could not levy on his Social Security. He was so sure that he argued with them and failed to follow the administrative procedures that might have enabled him to limit the amount that they could take of his Social Security. U.S. District Court on February the 21st, 2014, dismissed his suit for damages from the Social Security Administration for garnishing his retirement benefits for 33 months, holding that he failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. If Mr. Blanchette had cooperated with the Internal Revenue Service, and if he had provided information to the Revenue officer that was trying to collect his past due obligation, he probably could have limited the amount of his Social Security that they took to no more than 15% if he'd been able to show that the amount was important to his maintaining some sort of standard of living. But he didn't do what he needed to do. He fought, but he fought with the wrong tools. Also in this edition, the IRS has issued retirement plans frequently asked questions on EP team audit program, employer plan team audits. The large business and international division audits the tax returns of partnerships and corporations with assets greater than $10 million. The IRS created the employee plan team audit program to conduct audits of the qualified pension plans of those large employers. These frequently asked questions should help large employers prepare for and determine what to expect in an audit of their qualified plans. Now, by the way, this is the IRS issuing the frequently asked questions and making it clear that how they expect taxpayers to interact with them should be considered in light of the memo last year on the changes to the information document request process. The IRS believes, and they are imposing, rules on IDRs and the taxpayers' responses to IDRs that require taxpayers to respond timely to information document requests and that actually penalize taxpayers administratively if they don't respond. So all of these frequently asked questions, all this information that is being produced by the Internal Revenue Service to explain how their process works to taxpayers should be read in the context of the Information Document Request Program, which imposes new responsibilities and new timelines on taxpayers. We can't stall the IRS anymore like we used to do. Final regulations on property transferred for services. The final regs clarify that except as specifically provided in Section 83C3 and Reg Section 1.83-3J and K, a substantial risk of forfeiture may be established only through a service condition or a condition related to the purpose of the transfer. 2. In determining whether a substantial risk of forfeiture exists, based on a condition related to the purpose of the transfer, both the likelihood that the forfeiture might occur and the likelihood that if it did occur, the forfeiture would be enforced will be considered. Finally, except as specifically provided in Section 83C3 and its accompanying regulations, transfer restrictions do not create a substantial risk of forfeiture, including a transfer restriction that carries the potential for forfeiture or disgorgement of some or all of the property or other penalties if the restriction is violated. Now, the purpose of these regulations was to stop practices by some large corporations that were inventing bogus conditions in order to diminish the value of grants of property. So there is no substantial risk of forfeiture that can be engineered, which is not really a substantial risk of forfeiture. These regulations are for their purpose is to stop that particular practice. Then Revenue Procedure 2014-21, limiting the depreciation deduction on automobiles. This is a routine revenue procedure. We get it every year. The first tax year for automobiles, $3,160. The first tax year for vans and trucks, $3,460. No big deal, no big news there. Rebecca Smacky Hurd, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2014-17, holds the IRS properly disallowed an individual's deduction for her contribution to an IRA. The individual was, in fact, an active participant in a qualified plan, and her adjusted gross income exceeded the IRA contribution deduction phase-out amount. Ms. Hurd had two employers during the year in question. The first employer had no plan, no qualified plan. The second employer had a qualified plan, and Ms. Hurd was a participant in that qualified plan, which was disclosed on her W-2. The only contributions, however, in that year were her contributions. The employer made no contributions on her behalf. On that basis, she felt that she was not a participant in an employer's plan and therefore should be permitted to make a deductible IRA contribution. The court found otherwise. Section 219 limits the amount a taxpayer can contribute as a deductible IRA contribution if the taxpayer is an active participant in a qualified plan during any part of the year. For purposes of Section 219G, an active participant means, with respect to any plan year, an individual who actively participates in a plan described in Section 401A. If an employee makes a voluntary or mandatory contribution to a plan, the employee is an active participant in the plan for the taxable year, whether the employer makes a contribution or not. Finally, this week, we have a decision coming out of the Ninth Circuit affirming that an IRS tax lien survived the taxpayer's bankruptcy and the IRS may levy on the taxpayer's pension. Stuart A. Gross. The IRS remained an IRS lien remain on an individual's ERISA-qualified pension plan that was exempted from his bankrupt estate, and the IRS may levy on the plan to collect unpaid taxes. The bankruptcy proceeding did not affect the lien because the plan was excluded from bankruptcy. Now, you may remember the Patterson versus Shumate decision several years ago in which the U.S. Supreme Court said that the general creditors of a insolvent debtor may not take the insolvent debtor's ERISA plan balance. That is not effective as to the Internal Revenue Service. So the Internal Revenue Service had a lien on the pension. The pension was exempt from bankruptcy by operation of law, and the bankruptcy code says, with regard to assets that are part of the bankruptcy estate, but exempt from the bankruptcy proceedings, the bankruptcy code provides such property is not liable during or after the case for any debt of the debtor that arose before the commencement of the case, except a debt secured by a tax lien, notice of which is properly filed. Unlike liens on exempt assets, liens on pre-petition assets that are not included in the bankruptcy estate are not affected by the bankruptcy. So there is an exception to the rule that bankruptcy will do away with all of your debts. You can't get rid of the Internal Revenue Service with bankruptcy. They will come and take your pension. Well, that's it for this week. And as always, stay safe.